Content warning: this episode contains explicit language, violence, and sexual assault. More information and resources can be found in the episode summary. Before we begin, this month on April 15th was the four-year anniversary of the murder of David Josiah Lawson, a black 19-year-old Humboldt State University student. To date, none of the assaulting members have been held accountable and still move freely within this community. November 29th, 2021 is the trial date that David Josiah Lawson's mother, Charmaine Lawson, civil lawsuit alleging that the city of Arcata violated her constitutional rights by inadequately investigating the 2017 stabbing of her son. One way of supporting Charmaine Lawson is to go to Justice for Josiah Litigation Assistance, GoFundMe, and donate to help pay for disposition, transcript fees, investigator costs, expert witnesses, and attorney fees. You can find more information about this case in the episode summary, along with more ways to support the family, black communities, and the continual dismantling and unlearning of how anti-blackness and racism show up within our communities and within ourselves. Hi, and welcome back to Care Spells, a critically queer podcast where we delve into the magic of care work. I am your host, Lex Storms, and in this episode, I'm going to continue to discuss some of the history behind witches, care work, and later on, share an exciting conversation with another friend of mine who has been practicing transformative justice in the context of intimate partner violence and sexual assault. I have spontaneously decided to pull a tarot card for this episode, and I am pulling from the Fifth Spirit Tarot Guide by Charlie Claire Bergs, a tarot for a world beyond binaries. It's honestly one of my favorite tarot decks I've ever had in my life. So definitely look that up. So I'm going to do a spread. And second episode, we have Temperance. Wow. Yep, that's a great card. This is me improvising. So the Temperance card is number 14 of the major arcana. It is a fire Sagittarius Jupiter sign. It's main qualities are internal harmony, expanding beyond boxes, binaries, fluidity, interweaving, mixing of opposites, non-linear healing. And if you want to know more about that card, you just do what you want to do with that information, and there are plenty of resources out there. I'll try and post some as well. So last time we talked a lot about magic, what it can mean, how it's sometimes understood, and how sometimes, even though magic can be abundantly healing, it can also be utilized by humans in ways that are systemically harmful, i.e. exotifying or appropriating cultural practices. There's this really interesting essay written by Maria Mies, a feminist scholar, that basically outlines some of the history associated with European witches and colonization. Essentially, during the 14th century of Europe, elitists were like, what if we just go around plundering, telling everyone they're witches, kill them, and take their fortunes? And this happened. Enter the witch hunts. All kinds of folks were targeted by the church state, but especially the herbalists, birth workers, and femme queer folks that practiced magic connectiveness to the more than human world. But that's terrifying to the cis hetero patriarchy, so these elitists utilized this book called Malleus Maleficarum, also translated to The Hammer of the Witches. And can we just say that anyone who writes a book called Malleus Maleficarum is obviously bad news. The title sounds like an evil spell in and of itself, and it was. The book was supposed to be some kind of like guideline to finding out who was a witch. But just to give an example of how absurd these witch tests were, stones would be tied to people's feet and thrown into a body of water. If they sank and drowned, they were not a witch, and their soul was saved. If they floated to the top or were able to escape, they were a witch and were condemned to death. The witch hunts carried out the condemnation of earth practices. It also influenced ways in which gender is experienced, creating not only the gender binary, but a hegemony or hierarchy within that. And it funded elites to organize European colonization. The European church-state creation of the gender binary and hierarchy were attributing factors to how colonizers deemed people and cultures as civil or quote-unquote savage, which I'm hoping listeners are aware that those terms are saturated in justifications for the genocides of indigenous peoples. I'm talking about this because we have an obligation to understand the past and how it is lived today. As me and Christine kind of talked about last episode, there was a huge shift with those folks who started to use magic in their daily practices. And that can be a really amazing reclamation for individual and collective power. That said, specifically for white folks, we need to be aware about how our return practices of magic are directly related to colonization and deep-rooted belief systems of superiority. I was just on a few friends, Leah and Sierra's podcast called Dames in Disarray. You can find them on Spotify and Apple Podcast and on IG, that's Instagram, at Dames in Disarray, where we basically just make food and talk. It was super fun. So on there was this question that was brought up about how I might identify or describe a witch. And I want to make it abundantly clear that witches have existed forever and they are all over the world. People's relationship, language, culture, history are going to vary with what magic or witch means for them. And I can only represent and define those from my own experiences and identity, while also holding up and uplifting other folks' experiences and identities weaved within magic making. So what's care work got to do with this? I think of care work as a critical labor of love that is centering a collective understanding that we all have the right to food, shelter, healthcare, support, and joy. Let's unpack that. I say critical because all humans do not have the same access to live. Care work also manifests the right to defend and fight for ours and others' ability to access life. Dr. Beverly Daniel Tatum, a renowned educator, author, and activist, has a metaphor of how systemic harm can be addressed. In this clip that I want to show, she uses the metaphor of a moving walkway. For those folks that might not be accessible for you, I encourage utilizing the imagination of whatever works for you that mirrors her point. Here's a clip from a discussion she did in 2018.
And one of the pieces of feedback I got was keep in your analogies. And this one particular analogy was one that many people found helpful. And it's the analogy of thinking about the cycle of racism as kind of like the moving walkway at the airport, right? So if you imagine yourself at the airport stepping onto this moving walkway, and if we think about the fact that there are policies and practices that have reinforced racial hierarchies, that reinforce racism in our society, we may not be personally responsible for those policies and practices, but they're in place. And even someone who says, you know, I don't have animosity toward other people, I don't have prejudices that I'm aware of, and I'm being intentional in saying that I'm aware of, right? Because we all have prejudices, but even somebody who says, you know, I feel as though I am not reinforcing racism in the world, I'm trying to be, you know, someone who embraces equity, all of that. If you are standing on a moving walkway, those systems and practices that are in place that are just sort of self-perpetuating, if you're standing on that moving walkway, some people are on that walkway and endorsing where the walkway is going, right? They're endorsing that racism. maybe they're belonging to white supremacist groups, and they are actively walking. They're those people who are walking ahead, eager to get where that walkway is going. But there are other people who are just standing still. And those people who are just standing still may not want to go where that walkway is going, but if you're just standing still, you're going to end up there. It might not take, it'll take longer, but you're still going to end up the same place. And I think of the people who are walking fast as actively racist, but the people who are standing still as passively racist, right? Because they are also being carried along, participating in the process that that walkway represents. But if you say, okay, I'm not gonna turn, I don't wanna go where that walkway's going, I'm gonna turn around. Unless you start moving, actively walking, you're just traveling backwards, right? You know, and that's, and so the person who's just turning around might see themselves as passively anti-racist, but as I hope this image illustrates, they are maybe not aware because they're traveling backwards, but they're still moving in that direction. If you want to interrupt that process, if you want to interrupt the cycle, you have to be intentional and active. You have to be actively walking fast in the opposite direction in order to prevent ending up in that place.
This full clip will be made available in the summary. So when we are complacent, we are engaged, and it takes a critical returning to how we might reimagine ways of addressing and unlearning harm to cast spells of care work. That's why I wanted to take time and start talking about transformative justice as a form of care work. And honestly, there's such a plethora of resources and amazing individuals and collectives that have put in so much, like, just incredible labor of education in sharing and cultivating understandings and accessible ways of practicing transformative justice. There's such a rich and long history of responding to violence and harm in ways that do not perpetuate harm, that have been led by Black and Indigenous queer people of color. I'm thinking about the works of Insight and Ubuntu, the books The Revolution Starts at Home and Beyond Survival, which are necessary back pocket books just to have on deck. I've also attached an interview with Mia Mingus on an introduction to transformative justice on episode 5 of the podcast We Rise. In it, Mingus, who cites Adrienne Marie Brown as well, talks about transformative justice practice as a political framework and approach for responding to violence, harm, and abuse. Here's a video called What is Transformative Justice, produced by Miriam Kaba, Dean Spade, and Hope Dechter, featuring Adrienne Marie Brown, Mia Mingus, Stats Schmitz, Anne Russo, Esteban Kelly, Martina Cartman, Priya Rai, and Shira Hassan.
So when I'm trying to explain transformative justice to people, I usually back away from, I don't go straight at, okay, this is transformative justice. I usually actually go back to punitive justice. I start out with like what we're used to and what we've been socialized into is punitive justice. And then I ask people, if I'm in a room full of people, even in, you know, a room full of friends, I'll be like, how many of you grew up in an experience where you were punished when harm happened? And I give examples. You were expelled, you were put in detention, you were suspension, you put on timeout, but the main move was you're removed from community in some way because you've done harm. And people are like, oh yeah, you know, everyone either has that experience or they were part of spaces where they saw that experience. And then I'm like, you know, we age, we grow that up so that then you go into prison or you get the death penalty or you get canceled from your community, right? That same, it's the same process. So we live in this, that's what we're swimming in. And then I talk about restorative justice as a steps in the right direction, right? It's like harm has happened. How do we restore ourselves back to that relationship that existed before the harm happened? So I'm like, someone stole your purse. You get an apology. They do some community service. Hopefully we've returned to like where we were. But for me, I always say that doesn't go far enough because if the original conditions were unjust, then returning to those original conditions is not actually justice, right? You're just going to have someone who's like, great, now I returned everything to you. I still don't have anything and I'm still hungry and I still need something. So I'm like, so we need to go further. So to me, transformative justice, the first aspect of it is that it goes all the way down to the root system of the harm and says, how do we change, heal, transform, pull this up? What do we need to do at the root system so that this harm is no longer possible? Like, what we're trying to do is stop this harm from ever being possible again. And then how do we understand that the state is so committed to punitive justice, so the state is not going to be able to engage in transformative justice with us, so we don't go to the state to do this kind of deep work. And then how do we turn towards each other to hold this space? And in that turning to each other, we have to say, I believe you can transform.
The bare bones way I describe transformative justice to just anybody that I meet randomly is that it's a way of responding to violence and harm without creating more violence and harm. That's bare bones. What would it look like to respond to harm in a way that doesn't create more trauma, more pain, more harm? And then after that, I would also say the way that I talk about it is that it is a way to respond to violence within our own communities, which feels really important. So it's not this kind of missionary thing, in a way that doesn't rely on violence and state and oppressive systems, so things like police, prisons, the criminal legal system, the court system, ICE, the foster care system. And it also doesn't rely on normalized violence and systemic violence, like reinforcing harmful gender norms or vigilantism, but that it also, most importantly, helps to create and cultivate the very things that we know help to prevent violence, so things like resilience, safety, healing, connection, all of those things.
The way that I usually describe transformative justice is addressing harm, but also understanding why that harm happened and addressing the underlying dynamics that created conditions for this harm to happen in the first place. Mm-hmm. And so it's not just addressing the harm between two or more people, but addressing the conditions of the community that allowed for that to be normal.
Transformative justice asks us not only about accountability for the individual, for the harm that's been caused, but to think more largely about how all of us may have contributed or are contributing or are part of these systems that create the harm that we're trying to address.
It distributes the culpability a little bit, which isn't to say, again, that it's even, but everyone holds some amount. Everyone holds some amount. You know, what environment enabled the silencing to go on such that this pattern was able to continue until a crisis? You know, what allowed things to escalate? What were the subtle hints around male supremacy and sexism and white supremacy or different forms of class power that gave people hidden messages that this was acceptable or that we're not going to intervene or that we're not, it's not of a scale yet that we're going to intervene and say something now to cut it out or to transform, waiting till things get to a point of crisis?
I think that any case that's presented to us, it's very, very likely that other people in that community are experiencing similar things, maybe not to that degree, or maybe not with that language. And it's actually by addressing what's happening between those people that you can understand the underlying dynamics and create tools and practices to address those for other people as well. And I think our interpretation of transformative justice also includes like most community organizing. I feel like most things that folks are doing to shift the underlying dynamics of violence in our society are making more resilient and accountable communities as well, are making it so that people are less likely to be harmful. And so we have a very open interpretation of what transformative justice is.
So instead of zooming in on this harm, this transgression, which is what the criminal legal system looks at, and then coming up with a punishment for it, it zooms out and is like, what's all the context? What's the environment in which this was allowed to happen? And how does that inform what needs to be explored as we work on healing and as we work to transform not just the person who holds the disproportionate amount of responsibility for causing harm or inflicting harm or exacerbating patterns of harm, but ideally, on the other side of a transformative justice process, we've explored enough things that the environment has shifted.
I mean, to me, it means that we actively think about every response that we have as an opportunity to break generational cycles of harm and violence, that we actually think beyond just individual incidences and understand both the micro and the macro, both the individual and the collective. How do we operate in a more long-term understanding of violence, a more generational understanding of violence, so that, you know, that we move past just the immediacy of a feeling of revenge, or that we need to get back at somebody, for example, or a feeling of hopelessness, to actually say, this is an opportunity that I can respond to this. I can either respond to it with more violence and harm, right, and escalate it, or I can take this opportunity to figure out, how do I de-escalate this, and what would that look like?
For me, transformative justice is a practice that I feel like is a life practice. Like, how do I, because harm is happening everywhere, from, you know, really little to really egregious. And so if we're really thinking about this, how can we really think about prevention? How can we really think about building relationships where we really encourage each other to take accountability for small things, not only the large? And I think that's preventative to larger, more egregious harms.
Handling the small things and addressing them well can actually help to prevent the big things. And so I get really excited around, like, the nerdy things of, like, going back to the basics and starting with, like, how do we build basic communication skills? How do we build the skill set to be able to give a good apology? What does it look like to be able to, you know, have generative conflict with the people in our everyday lives? How do we talk about accountability and help and support each other to heal with the people in our everyday lives? Those things make me excited. How do we teach our children about consent and accountability? How do we show up for the youth and the children in our lives? And I know it seems less connected to transformative justice, because when we talk about TJ, everyone goes to, like, automatically the most horrific forms of violence and the big forms of violence. But, you know, I think that so much of our work is doing, you know, building the foundation that we need for transformative justice. And if we all just rush always to the crisis, we miss the more sustainable everyday things that, to me, actually are, when they ripple out, are a bigger force that can change things.
Transformative justice is just the things we do to support each other to survive in this world, from the small things to the big things, like what we do for the people in our communities to help us survive violence. And I think of it as, so transformative justice as both about how we prevent violence, how we intervene in violence, and then how we support each other in the aftermath of violence through healing or accountability or both. And it's all of those things.
I really think about the generations of people who have always been doing this, even though they didn't call it transformative justice. And I just want to lift up all the work of immigrants, queer people of color, disabled folks, sex workers, the people who have never been able to rely on folks outside of their communities.
What I want people to hear when they hear TJ is that this is a set of practices that happens outside of the state. So this is not something that you can take into schools. I want people to take the values into schools, or I want people to take the values into broader institutional work. And those values are around ending prisons and around transforming our understanding of accountability and disconnecting the idea of punishment and justice. But I want people to know that TJ has to happen outside the state. It is not something that we can just turn into another systemic response.
Ugh, so good. If you have the time, I would encourage folks to watch, listen, read all of the videos released in that series. I'll make sure to make a post with the one that was just played, along with where you can find the rest. And without further ado, here's a conversation I had with Fig. Fig is a non-binary human person living on occupied Wiat land in Arcata, California. They are a friend, a community organizer, a student of transformative justice practitioners, a visual artist, a writer, a singer, screamer of songs, a feeler of feelings. Most recently, they've been writing a series of 100-word pieces on polyamory and exchanging them with new friends. Writing can be found at feelingisgoodfig.wordpress.com. They aspire to meditate more, have been working with Akashic Records for the past few months, and they're interested in the ways that our everyday actions can manifest magic. Survival kit includes a bathtub, being held, rain, the night sky, mood lighting, their dog, and soup. This is our recording. It's already, like, vulnerable and, like, embarrassing to do anything, like, creative, which is great, with one of the beauties about it, but also...
I used to say, to do anything.
Yeah, period.
it's vulnerable and then embarrassing to leave your house in the morning.
Everything. Wait, restart. Hi, Fig.
Hello.
I have.
Hi, Lex.
Hello. It's happening. I have some questions for you. And I'd really love to start with.
I love that. That you have questions for me.
Great. I'm glad we're on the same page.
Can we just, like, say how we know each other?
Yeah. We go way back. We go to...
Just so far back. Well...
the college. We started in college together, but we didn't actually know each other. I knew Fig from just their name being mentioned in circles and everyone being like, wow, that's a really great name. I'm like, wow, I want to know this person. I didn't meet them till, like, probably... 2 years after knowing their name and some things about them, like an amazing songwriter and singer. To this day, I'm like probably a pretty big groupie. I don't know. How do you feel about that situation?
I feel like you're a great groupie and definitely in the number one fan club. For Blood Honey, yeah.
Yeah!
And I like to say, how I followed Lex into two separate jobs, which I feel like is random. You worked at our university's Women's Resource Center, and then I worked in that same job after you. And then we worked in the same position at a separate intimate partner violence organization. So I'm just like always just a little bit behind you in the career, not in like a way, but just, you know, following in your footsteps. And and now we're just friends. Now we're not coworkers. We're
friends. Now we're just friends.
Love it.
Love it.
Love it. So, like, we have this. Basically, we know each other originally through a shared, like, you know, passion of supporting survivors, and it just kind of went from there. To summarize it,
I think that's a great summary.
Thank you.
I have a question now. When exactly did you first start learning or practicing transformative justice?
Yeah, so I, like, in 2018, I think, I had been, like, you know, dabbling in some self-taught, reading and stuff about transformative justice, you know, the classics, like, you know, Mia Mingus and Mariam Kaba, listening to podcasts, just things like that. You know, I was super interested in it, especially working in a domestic violence nonprofit, where I was like, wow, the court system and also, like, our organization really does not very much to, like, ultimately address the cycle of violence within like intimate partner violence and domestic violence. As much wonderful work as like, you know, advocates do at shelters and stuff like that, you know, it becomes pretty clear ultimately that like when you're in that job, that it's just fucking endless. And so I think I just, you know, almost, I think from a bit of a sense of hopelessness around that and burnout, was just like, okay, like what the fuck could I be putting my energy into that is actually gonna like eventually make this violence stop happening, rather than just like putting out all these fires as they happen and never interacting with or addressing the people who are causing the harm. So yeah, in like 2018, there was a like call out in my community, where someone who was actively engaged in both the art as well as like, you know, activism scenes was outed as having taken advantage of somebody, and assaulting somebody. And so I had like just, I don't know, I was just like, yeah, this is, I'm like ready to try and make something happen. I wasn't, spoiler. but yeah, so like, I guess, you know, since like 2017-ish, kind of studying, reading, listening, thinking about it, talking about it as a concept, and then really kind of earnestly started to try and do transformative justice practices in 2018. However, I'm realizing, even as I'm saying this, just something that I was thinking about in preparation for this episode, which is that like, something that I'm really interested in doing is like changing the way that we even like training, like what we think about as transformative justice and what we call transformative justice. One of the last bits of the first section of this episode, has Mia Mingus talking about how like the little things that are transformative justice, right? And how like we want to respond to these big acts of harm, and yet oftentimes the things that can have the bigger like ripple effects and the bigger, deeper, longer term outcomes in our communities are like these small things, like learning how to communicate, learning how to apologize, learning how to set boundaries and things like that. And so I'm trying in my own life and starting to want to take it out into my community after thinking about it for a long time, just changing the way that we're framing transformative justice. And so in that sense, I want to say like maybe since 2016, we're really like, this question is so messy. I'm like, when did I first realize that I didn't want to be like my parents? Like, whenever that was, that's when I started practicing transformative justice. So, like, I was born in 1991, so maybe like 1999.
I feel like when my conscience was growing.
And I, yeah, because really, and you know, we could get into that more, but yeah, like, I really just think that transformative justice is about fucking breaking cycles of violence, like when it really comes down to it. And so like any work that you are doing that is in service of that is transformative justice. And so I'm like, yeah, I've been doing that shit since I was a kid, because I've, you know, recognized in some way or another like abuse dynamics in people around me since I was pretty young. And I think a lot of us do, because we recognize pain when we see it. So yeah. But like in the way that we like say that, you know, community accountability, like a more like kind of formal way.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent answer. And that's funny. I remembered like when I was listening to specifically that part of Mia Mingus, I had a very similar reaction to thinking about like, wow, that's been like happening for a while too. And especially, yeah, we're constantly gaslighting each other. We're living in an extremely emotionally abusive gaslighting culture right now. Mm-hmm. And it has been that way for a while. And so looking at transformative justice as like, just like when the extremes are happening, those are the things that we think about transformative justice as, versus like, oh, transformative justice is like recognizing that maybe the way that you're, or like communicating to a coworker or a friend, mm-hmm. and you're having a moment that is projecting, recognizing that and unlearning that is part of the power of transformative justice.
Yeah, and like, which total, and it makes sense, right? It and is kind of, it's like the irony of a lot of times, you know, in our communities, people are like, yeah, very quick to rush to that work of like I think there's a way in which our attitudes towards transformative justice sort of indicate that we lack an understanding of how violence works, mm-hmm. in that there's like the most egregious forms of harm, the most traumatizing, you know, like individual incidents are supported by all these, you know, everyday normalized things. And so I think that's a reflection of that. And then also, yeah, it's just like, it's just, I don't know. I've just been like almost laughing recently. I'm just like, I can't believe that we think we can address such horrific acts of violence as a community when like we literally can't talk to each other about like the most basic shit.
That's real.
Like, how do we think, like, how are we, like, we're gonna come together to address this like assault, and it's like we literally don't have never come together around like more, you know, foundational, arguably like easier to address things. And so that's mm-hmm. kind of a direction I'm going with it too, is like, bro, like we just aren't ready. I don't know, and I that might be like, I don't even know, like that might be a unpopular opinion. I say this too coming from having attempted several transformative justice community accountability processes that you know, I don't really like to use the terms like failed or succeeded, but like weren't good, didn't mm-hmm. go well. And from my perspective and reflections on it, I was like, I don't think we were ready. Like as a group, as a community, the people that were trying to do it, it's just like, we hadn't done that foundational work of trust building with each other, you know, of anything. And that's not to say like, don't address something if you want to address it, but that's just to say like, if it's really your commitment, like if you're going to say it's your commitment, use the time before the incidents come to public attention to like scale build.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm curious, because when I think of those moments of like, you know, holding folks accountable or going through a process of transformation to find justice in and for a situation, there is a sense of urgency, you know, to be able to fix it immediately. And sometimes that, you know, comes from this like cultural aspect of essentially like supremacy, where it's like, go, 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 we need to like fix this immediately, and then like we don't have to think about it anymore. And you know, and like that's really difficult though too, when we're talking about, you know, like I've been in situations where I have been assaulted, or I need the person that has caused me harm to be accountable immediately. And it's really, really, really hard not to have an immediate like process or like an immediate call out or like a person not be aware of the harm immediately. It's hard to like sit with that, and it feels like it almost feels like this like source of like abandonment, you know, from community.
Yeah, and also just to say too, like when I say that I don't necessarily like, I'm moving away from like encouraging people to do processes when there's been no preparation, like support survivors still. And and I think supporting survivors is of all the things that happen in like transformative justice processes that I've witnessed, supporting survivors is like to a degree the easy part, because like it's like, okay, we come together, like and it can be just something as simple as, right, like someone committing to like a weekly check-in with this person, you know, or you know, and there's a lot of times tangible needs that somebody might have, you know. In the case of this first process that I referenced from 2018, we did like a fundraiser for the survivor. Like we sold art to raise like money for them. There's like very tangible things that we can do to like rally around survivors. And I think that should always be happening no matter what. I think my hesitancy with the accountability side of it, in terms of people doing it when they're unprepared, is what I've seen happen and what I have honestly done myself, is committed to a survivor to like trying to do a process with to trying to support a harm doer in being accountable, and then like not being able to do it and like not having the skills, not having the capacity, trying to do it alone, which I have since was like, I'm never gonna try and do that alone again, right? And so just, and I, my concern is, you know, and I'm not a fucking authority, right? It's like, these are just my thoughts. Like my concern with it is that like, we're gonna, like, I think it's very important to not make promises to survivors that we can't keep, and like not make commitments. Cause like you're talking about like a sense of abandonment. And like, I think it's like, show up after the harm, like rally around this survivor. If all that means is just like offering emotional support, taking them food, like I think that is still a lot more than what usually happens. And I think that even if that doesn't entail walking like with the harm doer, providing them support, I think that's still better than nothing, you know? Because I think I just want people to be honest about their capacities, because again, I've just seen a lot of commitments being made and then dropped, and survivors expressing like, yeah, like what the hell happened? Like, why was there no follow through on this? And I almost think that's worse than just upfront being like, hey, like we hear that what you're asking for is like an accountability process. There's no one in our community that's doing accountability processes. Like, if that's the reality of the situation, like that's the reality, you know what I mean? Yeah. And I just, yeah, I think again, like if what we're saying is we're committed to making that a reality where the processes can happen, we have to invest time into the skill building, right? And with, you know, those foundational skills, which is like what I've been kind of trying, like I've stepped away a little bit from these like conversations around like these processes in my community, and trying to regroup and figure out like, okay, how do I facilitate this kind of skill building with people in my community? Like one thing I really want to do is Mia Mingus has a like how to give a good apology blog post, and I also had the immense privilege of attending her how to give a good apology, like 3-hour lab in person at the beginning of 2020 before everything closed down. Yeah, it was fucking awesome. And so like, that's something that I would like to do for my community is kind of recreate that lab to some extent and find other ways. Like, I just found a book called Unfuck Your Boundaries. And I'm looking into it because I'm trying to see if it seems to have good reviews from what I can tell so far, but things like that, and be like, hey y'all, like let's look at setting boundaries, you know, because like that's the thing too, right? It's like, okay, are we really gonna like send someone, like ask someone who has no experience in this to like try and support a potentially very manipulative and kind of dangerous person, right? Like, okay, go work with this like abuser, even though like you don't have the skills to set boundaries in your own life, like we're like, you're gonna be able to do it with this like potentially super manipulative person, right? Like, to me it just doesn't really like track that or seem like a responsible thing to do.
Yeah, and it's also rippling the harm.
Yeah, like it's so like, I think like it can be so fucking serious, you know, like we have like serial abusers in our community, and like I think that while you don't have to be like, I don't want to sound like I think you need to be like a trained professional to do this kind of work, I think that there are definitely some foundational skills that are needed to navigate, you know, so even like things like a basic understanding of like power and control dynamics, how manipulation works and things like that are really important if you're going to be working with someone who's caused harm, because they can and will replicate those dynamics. And if, especially if you yourself are like a survivor trying to do that, that could be super triggering to like be experiencing that as well. So yeah, not just like hate on, you know, obviously whatever, like I just think there's a lot more foundational work that needs to be done, especially where we live in a rural community. There's not like the fucking Bay Area Transformative Justice Collective doing workshops all the time that we can like, you know, we're kind of like building things from the ground up here a little bit. So yeah.
Yeah, what stood out for me too when you were talking about just going into like transformative justice practices or like accountability practices alone and not as like a collective, I feel like that was a really important point, because we do need like mentors. We need to constantly being like, not just like holding other people accountable, but also like holding ourselves accountable within that process. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I think, yeah. And I've done that multiple, I've done that twice now where I was like, I can work with this person who's caused harm by myself, and like, no, bitch, you can't. And at least I can't. And one of the reasons, and the things I've seen too, because guess what? Like holding someone who's caused harm, supporting someone who has caused harm is uncomfortable, and you don't really want to do it. It's not fun. The person who's being asked to be in this process probably doesn't really want to be there. So now you just have two people who don't really want to be there. Like, nothing makes fucking scheduling something harder than two people don't want to do it. Like, even if it's on a subconscious level, right? Like, that's straight up something I feel like I've seen so many times and experienced myself, where things just fade away because it's kind of like, So even like a third and fourth person to be like, hey, when are we meeting? You know, like even just in a practical sense, like, so yeah. Yeah. And yeah, just someone else to be like, hey, when they said that, like, you know, did you feel like they were totally, you know, like, does that sound like victim blaming to you? Yeah, that should sound like victim, you know, like just someone to kind of bounce separately, being able to discuss like the conversation that was had with the person who caused harm, to like get to an understanding of like where they're at and what needs to happen to move forward. So I also wanted to like say something else I wrote down was that, like, whenever we talk about transformative justice and community accountability, we're, like, always thinking about other people. It's, like, always something that someone else did, you know? And so I also just really want to encourage us, like, to, like, when we think about transformative justice, to automatically just be, like, considering ourselves as, like, in need of that practice and mm-hmm. not just being like, oh yeah, that's just when other people do something really messed up. Like, no, it's like we were kind of saying earlier, it's like when you take responsibility for projecting on your coworker, like you said, you know.
Yeah.
Yes.
To catch the rest of the conversation, find it on the second episode, part 2. Fig can be reached personally on Instagram at feelingisgood.fig or email feelingisgood.fig@gmail.com. Their music can be found on Instagram at Blood Honey Music. Blood Honey is BLOODHUNNY and Blood Honey on Bandcamp. Follow the podcast on Instagram at @carisbells. Or through the website where all episode transcripts will be made available at www.carespells.com. For any questions, feedback, colons, or expansions, you can also email carespells@gmail.com.